Hello, and welcome to the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of the Endocrinology Network, and I will be your host for this episode. In this episode, you will hear my conversation with Dr. Muthiah Vadugunathan, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Vadugunathan was also the member of the writing committee for a recent AHA scientific statement regarding the cardiorenal benefits of SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. In the following interview, Dr. Vadugunathan offers insight into the writing process and his perspective on how the most recent trials for these agents have added to our understanding of both classes. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Vadugunathan. Just give our audience a brief introduction on who you are and your relation to this latest scientific statement from the AHA, then we can dive into questions.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's really a pleasure. My name is Muthu Vadugunathan. I'm a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And I was part of the writing group for this most recent American Heart Association scientific statement on cardiorenal risk amongst patients with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And this was a multidisciplinary writing group of endocrinologists, nephrologists, and cardiologists working together to summarize and put forth kind of summary statements related to the recent scientific advances.
All right, and I guess the first question I have for you would really be, what's the significance of this statement? We've been seeing a ton of data related to SGLT2s and a ton of data related to GLP-1s. What's it mean for sort of the role of this class that AHA has gone as far as releasing a scientific statement on where they stand?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. The entity of chronic kidney disease and its overlap with cardiovascular disease is really unique amongst other comorbidities in that it not only identifies an extremely high-risk population, but it also limits a lot of our established therapies commonly used in clinical care. And so I think we've had a very unique opportunity recently in advancing these two classes of therapies, the SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, that have not only been safe, but in many regards have been quite effective at low eGFR ranges. And so this was with the recognition that this is a high-risk overlap. These are new therapies that are underutilized overall, but may have a particular role in improving cardiorenal risk in this high-risk overlap population.
All right, thank you for that. And now, one of my next questions, sort of following up on that, you guys did a great job of sort of laying out all the information from the trials that you selected for inclusion in this statement. Now, we've seen half a decade elapse from the release of the first trial included in this and the release, you mentioned VERTIS-CV, which was fully released just a few months ago. How has the role of the class sort of in the hierarchy of research needs changed? I'm sure 5 years ago, if you were to tell somebody that SGLT2s would be headlining basically every single cardiovascular conference, it may have turned a couple heads. Now it's commonplace. How has that evolved for you as someone involved in research and sort of practice background?
Absolutely. I think it's a remarkable story, and you're absolutely correct. It was 2015 when EMPA-REG OUTCOME was published, and in just 5 years, we've seen a rapid branching of clinical trials and advancing the evidentiary base for this class of therapies. I think it's actually should be a paradigm for how future scientific discovery should be conducted, in which initial signals, even if unanticipated or unexpected in the context of the original trial, should be rapidly pursued to advance and actually identify the highest risk populations as well as the maybe highest yield advantages of those therapies. And so while the initial four cardiovascular outcome trials evaluated high-risk type 2 diabetes, now we have strong evidence that these therapies are effective in chronic kidney disease and heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, even among those without diabetes. And so it's so rapidly evolved. I think we're very thankful to the investigators, the patients and sponsors that have made this possible to have actually eight pivotal randomized clinical trials executed within such a short period of time is actually remarkable in itself, and I think is a testament to the broad commitment from a lot of these parties in advancing best science to support our patients.
Yeah, it's definitely been an amazing collaborative effort to sort of sit back and watch. I can't imagine how it's felt for you in the past few years working with so many different specialists. Now, when we talk about sort of the risk benefits of SGLT2s, mostly in part to these recent trials, it's very well understood. The one thing that stands out is this FDA warning of increased amputation risk for patients taking canagliflozin. What do you make of that? We've seen a lot of research that's come out sort of disputing that. What do you make of that, and how should clinicians take that into account when thinking about prescribing these agents?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking that question, Patrick, because I think it's important that we communicate the best available evidence to clinicians and patients about not only the benefits, but also the risks of these therapies. The amputation signal was seen in one trial, CANVAS, and not replicated in seven other large-scale randomized clinical trials, including another clinical trial studying the same therapy, canagliflozin, in a higher-risk patient population of chronic albuminuric chronic kidney disease. And I think that it's certainly possible that it was a chance finding in the initial trial. And the fact that it was not replicated gives me, in a high-risk population, does give me reassurance that this risk can't be generalized across the therapeutic class, and maybe not even generalizable to other indications. I think it's worthwhile to point out that in the CREDENCE trial, they did introduce a protocol amendment to have investigators examine patients' feet for every clinic visit and investigator visit. And I think that may have modified the associated risks of the therapy. The therapy was disrupted if there were active foot lesions present during any of these visits and then reintroduced upon healing. And so I think that's a protocol that's consistent with clinical practice guidelines for general diabetes care. And I think it's more important now that we have these therapies. That said, given the totality of evidence, 8 randomized clinical trials, only one showing a potential signal, absolute risk still being very low in that trial of the amputation risk. I think given the totality of evidence, I was very pleased to see that the FDA took the next step in actually removing that black box warning recently in August. While it's a consideration, I don't think it certainly should be a contraindication or something that should prevent us from optimizing care of these patients.
All right, and then staying on the topic of SGLT2s, what do you think are the biggest barriers to the prescribing SGLT2s sort of at the proper rate that we should be doing? And is it sort of clinical inertia, or I've heard a lot of people cite costs? What do you think are the biggest barriers to this?
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. I think, you know, as with many things in medicine, it's a convergence of factors. And I think that the two that you had mentioned of clinical inertia and cost are probably chief among them. I'm hopeful that the SGLT2 inhibitors are actually fairly unique compared to other novel therapies in that we've rarely seen a therapy being shown to be effective in so many different therapeutic domains in such a short duration of time. So I'm hoping that creates enough momentum that it actually reaches patients, reaches clinicians, and spurs change and helps overcome that therapeutic inertia. Costs are an issue with the adoption of any novel branded therapy. I think there has been improvement and progress in terms of coverage. Has been fairly progressive in terms of covering the SGLT2 inhibitors, and I think that I'm hopeful that as health systems also attempt to adopt these therapies on a broader scale, there may be greater cost sharing and opportunities to actually reduce out-of-pocket costs for borne by patients.
All right, and actually just one last question for SGLT2s, and this, I guess it's a two-part question. Now, we see in a lot of these trials, almost everything for EGFR cutoff is 30. Now, what would your take be on prescribing that to patients with an EGFR sort of approaching that mark? Is it an immediate no-go for you, or what kind of factors do you take into consideration then?
Yeah, it is a very interesting intersection of these SGLT2 inhibitors, EGFR, and RISC. The SGLT2 inhibitors, very similar actually to the renin-angiotensin system inhibitors, cause a transient dip in EGFR and then subsequently allow for long-term kidney protection. And while at low EGFRs, many clinicians may be cautious about using these therapies, in fact, they're actually quite effective, and now we have dedicated chronic kidney disease studies that have shown they're not only effective, but life-saving in many, many cases. And so I think that part of this needs to be coupled with education to clinicians that this dip is expected, that long-term the EGFR is expected to stabilize and even plateau and prevent further decline. I think also we need to broaden education that these aren't necessarily kidney toxic, meaning that there's no evidence that these are actually injurious or causing permanent kidney injury. That transient EGFR is a physiological effect that's expected and anticipated at the level of the glomerulus and is reversible and plateaus over time. The individual cutoffs for each randomized clinical trial does vary. In general, they've been about, in recent trials, have gone down to an EGFR of 20, for instance, in the EMPEROR-reduced trial, or 25 in DAPA-CKD. And so I think we're learning that the safety profile can be extended well to low EGFR ranges. And so if you are caring for a patient on an SGLT2 inhibitor with progressive chronic kidney disease, consistent with these trial protocols, these therapies were not disrupted unless the patient was initiated on hemodialysis. And so I think that should be our clinical practice as well, that they should be continued, and they still do offer a cardiorenal protection well down to a low EGFR. Unless these patients are started on dialysis, I think they can be maintained in clinical practice.
Okay, and the second part of that question, the JACC just recently released a expert consensus statement, or it might have been decision pathway, where they recommended prescribing SGLT2 inhibitors to diabetic patients without CVD, but at high risk of atherosclerosis. Where do you stand on that, and do you think that that's a recommendation that you would endorse to clinicians?
Yeah, it's another really important question in the allocation of these therapies to lower risk populations. Until now, we've been discussing this higher end of the spectrum, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, established cardiovascular disease. But what about the lower end of the spectrum? What about the patients with type 2 diabetes without an overt clinical event of cardiovascular disease, without chronic kidney disease? It's important to acknowledge that these are, in general, lower risk patients, so they're going to be less likely to have clinical events in the near future, meaning they need to be treated for a longer period of time to accrue the necessary clinical benefits seen in many of the clinical trials. Of the four pivotal cardiovascular outcome trials that studied high-risk type 2 diabetes, two evaluated substantial proportions of patients who did not have established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. That was the CANVAS program and the DECLARE-TIMI-58 trial. And DECLARE-TIMI-58 actually has probably one of the largest samples of patients evaluating this lower end of the spectrum group of patients. And it's important to recognize that the relative benefits, especially related to prevention of heart failure events, was very comparable in that group of patients. And so I think that we would be, these are effective therapies for sure. The cost effectiveness of the allocation of those therapies does shift when you get to lower end of the spectrum, because you're going to be preventing perhaps fewer events for a given number of patients treated. And so I think that's a conversation that needs to occur within each health system, each country, to understand who should be covered and is it a value added to the overall health system. There's no question these have effectiveness even at the lower risk end. I think it's just, it now comes down to a value question, because these are, of course, therapies that with associated cost.
Okay, and then just for, it's kind of amazing to think that we've had a number of new studies come out since you guys started writing this statement, and you touched on it a little bit in terms of use in patients with an EGFR below 30 or approaching 30. Is there anything else that the more recent SGLT2 studies add to our understanding of these that you want to touch on, specifically Virtus CV, DAPA CKD, and Emperor Reduce?
Yes, I think it's been remarkable, and it was actually quite challenging to write this scientific statement, because we understood we were on unsteady ground with a rapidly evolving evidence base, and so this scientific statement's actually accompanied by a commentary as well as an updated slide set to allow for clinicians to actually go through some of the more recent advances, including publications in the last 1 to 2 months in the New England Journal of Medicine. So I think that based on the totality of evidence, it's very clear that one, the SGLT2 inhibitors have an important cardioprotective role in high-risk type 2 diabetes. Two, they have a clear role in treating patients with albuminuric chronic kidney disease, meaning chronic kidney disease with high albuminuria, with or without type 2 diabetes. And three, they have a very clear role in treating heart failure with reduced ejection fraction with or without diabetes. Now, open questions that are being examined in ongoing clinical trials are, one, patients who are early after myocardial infarction who have not developed overt heart failure or don't have other treatment indications for SGLT2 inhibitors. So that post-MI setting, I think, will be very interesting, is underway. Heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, the other 50% of the cohort with heart failure, very high-risk cohort without current treatment options, also being actively pursued. Non-albuminuric chronic kidney disease, these are chronic kidney disease patients with lower levels of albuminuria, is being tested in another randomized clinical trial. And then other clinical trials are assessing patients who are hospitalized for heart failure, for acute decompensations of heart failure. And I think we'll learn more about their safety and efficacy in that high-risk setting. And then finally, a trial that's due to report very shortly of COVID-19 and the effects of dapagliflozin in that high-risk setting. So I think we're about halfway through in terms of the wealth of data that's emerging. We've learned a tremendous amount already about the foundational role of these therapies across cardiometabolic and kidney disease states. And now we're poised to expand that knowledge.
All right, thank you for that. And that is it's kind of amazing to think that we're gonna be talking about those things in just a few short months or years. And now, one of the other things I wanted to touch on for both of these sort of classes of therapies is prescribing them in relation to other agents as well. Specifically, I wanted to talk about first diuretics and then RAS inhibitors as well. So if you could take me through, do you have any concerns when it comes to co-prescribing with diuretics for either of these agents? And then after that, RAS inhibitors.
That's great. Thank you for the question. So the SGLT2 inhibitors do have modest diuretic potential. And so it commonly comes up in clinical practice. What do you do when initiating an SGLT2 inhibitor amongst a patient who is already requiring a diuretic? In general, our current clinical practice or current clinical guidance suggests that you can start the therapy, have close follow-up, ask the patient to closely monitor their weights, congestive symptoms, and then closely reevaluate that. And in a patient who appears to have either improvement in clinical status or congestive status, they may be able to de-escalate an oral diuretic in follow-up. In general, for instance, in the pivotal DAPA-HF trial, there was actually very minimal background shifts in diuretics. So I don't think that at a population level, we're going to see a large reduction in use of diuretics. But in select patients, for sure, some patients may be able to lower their dose, or patients who are already on very low doses may be able to come off diuretics.
All right, and now could you take me through any issues that you might see co-prescribing with RAS inhibitors?
So certainly no issues with background use of renin-angiotensin system inhibitors. In fact, for instance, our chronic kidney disease trials, which are arguably some of our higher risk populations, required or mandated background maximally tolerated doses of renin-angiotensin system inhibitors. So these were specifically studied in combination as an add-on therapy on maximally tolerated RAS inhibition, and they're remarkably well tolerated. In terms of co-prescription, comes up sometimes with respect to heart failure and perhaps chronic kidney disease. Both classes of therapies are effective. Could we start them at the same setting? And I think in general, it's yes. We've had limited experience, and so I don't want to overgeneralize. Both do have important physiological effects on the glomerulus and intraglomerular pressures. So there is some concern that perhaps it could cause that early dip to be exaggerated. And perhaps some of the other side effects or adverse effects are overlapping between these two classes. For instance, they have some blood pressure lowering that may be additive or synergistic. They may have some effects on electrolytes, et cetera. But in general, I think they can be introduced very closely together and perhaps separated in terms of days or weeks to prevent any directly overlapping adverse effects.
Okay, and just lastly, before I let you go, I know I asked earlier about barriers to prescribing SGLT2 inhibitors. GLP-1s, obviously, the biggest barrier that everyone always brings up is patient adherence. Outside of patient adherence, what are barriers that are sort of preventing the optimal prescribing of GLP-1s?
That's great. So all of the currently cardioprotective GLP-1 receptor agonists, those therapies that have definitively been shown to reduce major adverse cardiovascular events, are all injectable therapies. And in general, for type 2 diabetes, most patients are accepting of injectable therapies because a large portion of patients are already on insulin. And adding another injectable is generally reasonable. However, there are patients that may have needle phobia or other maybe otherwise averse to initiating an injectable therapy. And I think that adding oral options has really been a clear interest amongst patients and clinicians. As of late last year, there is a new oral GLP-1 receptor agonist. It was shown to be safe with respect to cardiovascular risk, and it's currently underway in terms of cardiovascular risk reduction testing in a large-scale randomized clinical trial called SOUL. And so I think we'll learn more about whether we can actually use more easily adopted oral versions of the GLP-1 receptor agonist that may improve the overall uptake of these therapies.
Yeah, thanks for touching on the oral GLP-1. It's kind of amazing that it gets a little bit lost in the shuffle because of the giant spotlight that SGLT2s have taken. But that is about it on my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add about the scientific statement that you want clinicians to keep in mind?
No, I appreciate the interest. It was, you know, we hope that it was a timely update. And again, I think we're, while we've learned a lot, I think we're about midway through. I think we have a lot more to learn, especially about the application and the implementation of these therapies. What are the best settings? Who are the best patients? And how can we add comfort to a broad base of clinicians, generalists and specialists? So it was a very exciting last 5 years. I think it's going to be a tremendously exciting next 5 years.
All right. Thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great to chat with you. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell. Thank you for listening.